Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you are tuned into the Corbett Report podcast on this 17th day of January 2014. And this is not an edition of the regular podcast, nor is it a podcastumentary, nor is it an edition of Film Literature in the New World Order. No, this is an edition of Questions for Corbett, that podcast series, where, as you might expect from a title like that, I, Corbett, answer your questions. And on a deprogramming note, for those who are waiting on the edge of their seat in anticipation of the eagerly anticipated Federal Reserve podcastumentary that I promised at the end of last year, as I have noted in a few of my other works lately, that podcastumentary has really blossomed into a fully-fledged feature-length documentary. I've already put in hundreds of hours into the writing and researching of it, and will likely have to put in hundreds more into the editing and creation of the final documentary. So I can't say exactly when that's going to drop. It will be sometime in the next few weeks, but again, I can't say when it will be, but please look forward to it. I really do think that this is going to be an exceptionally valuable resource for talking to people about the Federal Reserve. And while we're waiting on that, I have this, of course, Questions for Corbett series, the Film Literature in the New World Order series, which will be coming out next Monday with the next edition. And for those of you playing along at home, you should watch and or rewatch Oliver Stone's 1987 film Wall Street and the 2010 follow-up Money Never Sleeps in preparation for that edition of the Film Literature New World Order series. And who knows, there might be a regular podcast or two that might drop along the way. But in the meantime, again, we are doing Questions for Corbett, and once again, I am answering your questions that come in either through the contact form on CorbettReport.com or questions that are tweeted to my Twitter account at CorbettReport using the hashtag QFC to let me know that you have a question. And also YouTube video responses, again, using the hashtag QFC so I can more easily find them. And really, any other way that you want to try to get this information in, these questions in for me, SoundCloud, audio recordings, or however you do, homing pigeon, whatever it is, I will be happy to consider all questions that come in. But on that note, of course, I get hundreds of questions for each edition of this series and thousands of emails every month, so I obviously can't respond to all of them. I can't answer all your questions. If you want your question answered, the best way to get that done is to keep your questions relatively short and sweet, make them as much to the point as possible, and also make them actual questions rather than just giving your opinion or your take on something and saying, what do you think? That's not really much of a question that I have to work with. So on that note, let's roll up our sleeves and get into it. And once again, I will stipulate that once again, with each episode of Questions for Corbett, I'm always looking for at least one person to write in with something positive that they have actually done or implemented in their lives based on the information they've gleaned from the Corbett Report, so that they can help share with others how to change their lives for the better. And so we'll be highlighting something like that in each episode of this Questions for Corbett series. And on that note, we have something on those lines towards the very end of this episode. But first, let's get into the questions. And we'll start by opening up the mailbag and going to an email from Judah, who writes, "After watching the Gladio B series, in which Sabelle gives concrete examples of the use of religion as a tool to divide and conquer, I was reminded of an Al Jazeera article I had read a while back about the myth of the Sunni-Shia religious divide. In it, the author argues that, while there is a real and historical difference in Sunni-Shia belief structures, such differences have not historically been the cause of violent tensions between the two peoples. Rather, violent disagreements are only a recent development that have been incited by the West and espoused by some regional state actors for their own geopolitical aims. What's your take?" Okay, thank you very much for that, Judah. And for people who are interested, Judah is referencing an Al Jazeera article called "The Myth of the 1400-Year Sunni-Shia War" by Murtaza Hussein. And just reading from that article, he writes, quote, "Analyses of the roots of sectarian conflict in the Middle East tend to look at the historical schism between Sunnis and Shias as the original driving factor behind present-day tensions. In this reading of events, the 680 AD Battle of Karbala, in which the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, who are particularly revered by Shia Muslims, were killed, was merely the first battle in a long and continuous sectarian conflict, which today is being played out in Syria, Lebanon, and other countries throughout the Middle East. As described by the Saudi writer Abdullah Hamidadeen, this explanation of contemporary events is as absurd as explaining modern tensions between Turkey and the EU as being rooted in the ancient conflict between King Charles and the Empress of Byzantium. positing that present-day political rivalries can be explained by examining 9th-century conflicts between European powers is transparent nonsense. However, the same logic is readily applied to conflicts within the Muslim world. End quote. Again, a very interesting and informative article with a lot of history in there, so I'll suggest that you go and follow the show notes for this episode of the Questions for Corbett series to take a look at that. But yes, broadly speaking, I do agree. I think that trying to simplify these really dynamic geopolitical situations that are developing in the Middle East and that we've seen playing out for at least the last century, obviously more than that, but certainly throughout the 20th century and into the 21st, to reduce all of that to a Sunni-Shia religious divide is obvious oversimplification, and it's not only wrong, I think it's dangerously wrong to make it that simplistic, because it obfuscates the real geopolitical machinations that are taking place in the region for very specific purposes, not only by outside foreign manipulation and intervention, although that is certainly a key factor in all of this, but also by the regional powers themselves in the region who are playing their own peoples in various ways to get their own geopolitical aims and goals. So I agree with that analysis. I think it is too simplistic, and on that note, people who are interested in exploring this in more detail, I'll point them to a very recent interview by MiddleEast.WeMagazine.net with Sharmeen Narwani, a former guest on the Corbett Report. And she talks about there is no middle in the Middle East today, basically talking about how it's not Sunni versus Shia so much as sectarian versus non-sectarian. And this is, of course, all taking place in a specific geopolitical context that's really about, for example, driving the wedge between the Iranians and the Arabs as a way of playing one regional power off against another in a geopolitical strategy of tension. That's really ultimately, I mean, the end goal of all of this is really more about forming those power blocks that are, as I constantly keep saying these days, are going to form the predominant Cold War myth of the next half century, which is the China-Russia Iranian allied power bloc versus the NATO-Israeli allies power bloc, which is taking shape now, and we see the lines forming along these, and through that lens we can see what's happening in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, in these places, not only in their own context, but in a much broader geopolitical context that literally spans the globe, from what's happening in South Sudan to what's happening in Ukraine, just all over the globe. We see things that seem very disconnected, and certainly there are actual people involved in these who really are authentic people who really believe that they're overthrowing this or protesting against that for whatever reasons. But really, ultimately, this is part of a larger manipulation that's taking place in a geopolitical context. So, long answer short, or short answer long, ultimately I agree. I think the Sunni-Shia divide is overplayed as some sort of explanatory device. I think it only applies to those the people who are being manipulated in this. And there are certainly Sunnis and Shias who really do hate each other. There are people within those groups who hate each other. There are people within those groups who don't hate each other. And there's Sunni-Shia intermarriages and the like that are all throughout the region. And even in these places where these big rivalries happen in Lebanon and places like this, Sunni-Shia intermarriage is not uncommon at all. So that's another way of showing the lie of this. So I think it's important to keep that bigger geopolitical picture in context. And on that very note, let's turn to the next question from Aladdin, who writes, I would like to know if the April 6th movement in Egypt is funded by foreign agents or intelligence. Is it a tool for destabilization in Egypt? And what is its agenda? Okay, again, thank you for the question, Aladdin, and long story short, yeah, it absolutely is, I think, funded by outside interests and for specific geopolitical purposes, and I think one of the most succinct and concise places that we can get that is from the Land Destroyer blog, where we had a article from February of 2011 talking about the CIA Coup College, talking about Canvas, Otpor, and the April 6th movement. And in this article, Tony Cartolucci connects these seemingly disparate groups, although they're not really so difficult to put together. I mean, the Otpor fist symbol is the exact symbol of the April 6th movement in Egypt. So, I mean, it's not like a close resemblance, it is the exact symbol. And when you start to look at this, they all have connections through things like Canvas in New York City. And all of this goes back to funding from outside actors, including Freedom House, the Albert Einstein Institute, the International Republican Institute, etc. Again, all documented there in that Cardellucci article and others that he's written, so I'll direct people to that. And the question of what is the greater goal, what is the greater agenda here, again, I do see this as part of the larger destabilization of that entire arc of crisis in North Africa, sweeping into the Middle East, along those lines that, again, are shaping towards the formation of the various power blocks for the next era of the next Cold War that they want us to believe in. That, again, I think is shaping up along the lines of China, Russia, Iran, those allied nations versus NATO, Israel, blah, blah, blah. I think that's the lines of the conflict that they want us to basically put our heads around. And I think that what's happening in Egypt is just one small part of that larger agenda. And that's why the U.S. State Department and others are actively involved in what's going on there. And that's not to say that it isn't a fluid situation that could take all sorts of different twists and turns. And I don't think these people control everything. So there's revolution and counter-revolution and counter-counter-revolution. And I've lost track of how many goes around they are in Egypt by now. But I think that my analysis of the situation way back in, I can't even remember which episode of the podcast, but a couple of years ago now, where we looked at what revolution really means, and that if you don't actually get rid of the underlying power structure, then it doesn't matter if you throw out the puppets here or there. It's still going to be the same thing in different, wearing different shoes, basically. So a lot to say on that front, but we'll leave it there for now. Again, yes, April 6th movement is foreign-backed and supported and funded, and there's all sorts of outside manipulation going on in Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and all throughout that region for a greater geopolitical purpose. And that reminds me of, if we're talking about the new Cold War of the 21st century, we should probably talk about the manipulated, staged, and phony Cold War of the 20th century, which, of course, was brought to you by the very same banksters, the international banksters, that reside in New York and London and based out of Germany and other places as well. And on that very note, we had another question in from Costa, who writes, "Do you think it could be true that New York banker Jacob Schiff helped finance the Bolshevik Revolution in 1918, and supposedly he gave Leon Trotsky, also known as Mr. Bronstein, $20 million in gold for that matter, a substantial amount of money for those times? If that would be the case, what possible reason would one of the world's most affluent capitalists of his time have to support the institution of communism in Russia?" Excellent question, Costa. Thank you for bringing it in. Although I should say that I don't think that anyone out there should care what I think or what I believe to be the case. It's not a question of what I think to be true. It is a question of what is demonstrably true or false, or what we can show to be true or false. So that should be the way that we think of these questions rather than do you think it is true. So again, it's not a question of whether I think it is true that Jacob Schiff helped finance the revolution. It's a question of what we can actually show from the documentary record. And on that note, I will, of course, once again, as I have many times in the past, exhort people to go back to the work of Anthony Sutton on the Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And of course, he has a book along with that title, and that goes into a lot of detail about the financing of the Bolshevik Revolution, specifically on the note of Schiff. In fact, he does talk about Schiff, but in a way that does not support the theory that Schiff was the one financing Trotsky or anyone else. In fact, in this, in Appendix 3 of this book, he goes on to state specifically that he does not believe that that Schiff was even supportive of the Bolshevik Revolution, and that, again, we find that from the documentary record from State Department cables that he was both involved in and mentioned in, and again, that can be found in Appendix 3 of Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. So, no, I don't think that the, again, what do I think? No, the documentary record does not support the Jacob Schiff giving $20 million to Trotsky, et cetera, et cetera. But on the note of Was this Bolshevik Revolution funded, supported, and aided by outside interests, including New York Wall Street financiers and Germans and British? Absolutely yes. And in fact, again, you can take that from the book, which I will once again exhort people to read, and it is available completely for free online, although it is, of course, also available for purchase. But absolutely, I think that that people should not only read that, but also look at the interviews that Anthony Sutton gave about this very subject.
Getting back to the Bolshevik Revolution, one of the ironies of it is that both Lenin and Trotsky were in exile, one in Germany, one in the United States. Tell us about how, who helped them get where they were going to make sure that revolution was pulled off.
Well, let me summarize about four chapters into 4 minutes. Trotsky was in New York. He had no income. I summed his income for the year he was in New York. It was about $600. Yet he lived in an apartment. He had a chauffeured limousine. He had a refrigerator, which was very rare in those days. He left New York and went to Canada on his way to the revolution. He had $10,000 in gold on him. He didn't earn more than $600 in New York. He was financed out of New York. There's no question about that. The British took him off the ship in Halifax, Canada. I got the Canadian archives. They knew who he was. They knew who Trotsky was. They knew he was going to start a revolution in Russia. Instructions from London came to put Trotsky back on the boat with his party and allow them to go forward. So there is no question that Woodrow Wilson, who issued the passport for Trotsky, and the New York financiers who financed Trotsky, and the British Foreign Office allowed Trotsky to perform his part in the revolution. Now, over in Switzerland, you get Lenin, who was in exile. He went through Germany in the famous sealed train by permission and with the encouragement of the German general staff. And yet Germany and Britain were supposed to be fighting each other. And you get them both moving these two key revolutionaries into place inside Russia. And then, of course, the rest is history. They created the revolution. With no more than about 10,000 revolutionaries, they needed assistance from the West, and they got assistance from Germany, from Britain, and from the United States to continue and consolidate the revolution.
Just tell us all over again why.
Why?
Just tell
you won't
it
find
again.
This in the textbooks. Why is to bring about, I suspect, a plan to control world society in which you and I won't find the freedoms to believe and think and do as we believe.
Did these power brokers actually envision at that time a one-world government that would be socialist?
Yes. The second statement I made was that they did not want the Soviet Union to develop into another free enterprise society, and that this would offset it. Aiding revolution would offset this event. That was made as a statement in 1919. You have various books, one by Gillette, the razor blade Gillette, called The City, I think it was, which laid out this corporate socialism for the world to see as early as, 1905, 1910. So around the turn of the century, you begin to see actually written statements by these internationalist businessmen of the kind of socialist empire they wanted to bring about. It's there, but these books, of course, are not included in your courses in political science and history at the regular universities.
In the interest of time, we're going to cut that interview short there, but I really do hope you'll follow the link to watch the rest of that video, and I hope you'll follow the link to read Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution in its entirety, as Anthony Sutton exhaustively documents from the documentary record itself how the international financiers in Wall Street, in London, in Germany, and elsewhere besides helped to not only foster and fund and bring about the Bolshevik Revolution, but then also propagandized for it after it had taken place. And the question again comes back to why? Why did they do this? Why would the bankers be interested in installing a socialist, a communist government, a Bolshevik government in Russia? Well, obviously, as Anthony Sutton says, absolutely in stark terms right there, it is the implementation of a one-world corporate socialist system. And unfortunately, here we are a century later and a century further along in the progression of the implementation of that agenda. And it continues to steamroll ahead. So it's exceptionally important that we understand that these conflicts are being engineered from behind the scenes and for specific purposes to herd us in a certain direction. And that's no less true of the developing Cold War of the 21st century than it was for the phony and stage-managed Cold War of the 20th century. Obviously, a lot more to say there, but let's move on again in the interest of time to the next question. We have an email in from Holly who writes, "My boyfriend is a huge fan. Any chance you could give him a shout-out in one of your podcasts for me? He would think it was so cool. He watches every single one." Well, thank you very much for that, Holly. It's very flattering, but I can't do that for your boyfriend, because if I did, then I'd have to do that for everyone's boyfriend. But, well, let me say this to you and to your boyfriend and to everyone else out there who is a regular listener or supporter of the Corbett Report, either monetarily or through just simply spreading the information around and sharing it with friends. I truly do want to give a shout out to all of you and thank you very much for supporting the Corbett Report, because it literally wouldn't be possible without all of you guys out there. Okay, next question comes from Flagler. Is neoliberalism the same as libertarianism? What makes it so bad? It seems like the only alternative is something of a socialist or interventionist nature, and it seems like you would be against that. End quote. Excellent. Excellent question. Thank you very much for this, Flagler. I really mean that, because this is an exceptionally important question to put out there on the table and to draw a very distinct line between the neoliberalian, the neoliberal and the libertarians. What is the difference anyway? I mean, doesn't it sound like a free market paradise, neoliberalism? What is neoliberalism? It's coming in and selling off the public infrastructure to private hands, so it's privatization of public infrastructure. Well, that sounds good. That's what free marketeers want. And lifting of sanctions, government intervention in the marketplace, trade barriers, tariffs, that kind of thing, lifting of all of those. Well, again, that's free market principles at work. So this is all for the good. What's wrong with neoliberalism then? But it is exceptionally important to understand that neoliberalism is not just not anarchistic or libertarian or free market in nature. It's almost even worse than just the regular machinations of the corporate socialist governments that Anthony Sutton was warning about. And we have to understand that the entire system is set up to extract as much wealth as possible from the masses through this imaginary obligation to pay taxes to this imaginary entity called government, which is really just a siphon. It takes all of that wealth that it's extracting out from the lifeblood of the average person and injecting it into the corporations, which again are government constructs that are populated by the cronies and the people who have paid off, in many cases, the governments in order to make this whole system function. So people have this imaginary obligation to an imaginary entity called the government. They pay their taxes, which then goes off into the corporate crony hands and the financiers and the like, who are again creating the money out of nothing. And throughout this whole system, all of this wealth and power and everything starts to get accrued in smaller and smaller cliques and cabals and the ruling bloodlines and the small family groups that control the vast majority of the wealth on the planet. And then in that state, once that incredible concentration has already taken place, for then what little does actually serve the public infrastructure that's been paid for, again, by the wealth that's been extracted at gunpoint from the average laborer, for that then to be sold at pennies on the dollar to that same corporate clique and cronies that have been extracting all of this wealth for decades and centuries, to call that free market is just... it's just absurd. It's just a disgusting perversion of the idea of what free markets are about and what people really mean when they're advocating for free markets. But that does bring up the very important question and the very important idea. Well, then, how do we transition? What is the method for transition from the current structure, which has been this centuries-long process of accumulation of wealth in a smaller and smaller cabal's group of hands? How do we transition from that into, well, okay, restrictions are all off and everyone, you know, go along your merry way? Obviously, that cannot be the way that we do it, because that will consign many, many millions who have been unfortunately placed into this system and made dependent on it, will consign them to death and will ensure that the people who are already at the top of this power pyramid will continue to hold their disproportionate power over the masses. So this is an exceptional extremely important question, and I think probably the most important question. I don't think that there's any question that voluntarism is the ethical construct that we have to use as the basis for our ethical system. But the question is, how do we transition off of a system that has been gamed for centuries without having that fundamental inequality that system itself has created perpetuate into the next stage of humanity's development? And that is a very important question that I won't bother to gloss over right now in a glib short answer in this time-constrained format. I think that's something that we all have to be working towards and make it very clear and put it all out on the table. So once again, I do thank you for asking that question, Flagler. I think that does go to one of the hearts of the problems, if I can use that phrase. Okay, let's move on to DJ Mongo, who is someone who's on Twitter. He's at JBryce. I've interacted with him on Twitter, so I will suggest that people out there do the same and follow him. And he puts in a YouTube video question under the QFC hashtag, so that was how I was able to find it. Now, this video is over 7 minutes long, so I'm, in the interest of time, not going to be able to play it for you, but I will put the link in the show notes so people can go and check it out for themselves. Basically, he is asking about a apparent contradiction between something that I said in episode 265 of the podcast and something that I said in a recent GRTV backgrounder, Media Lies and Syrians Die, talking about the idea of objectivity. And, of course, for people who did see episode 265, I was talking about the myth of journalistic objectivity and the idea that there is no way to achieve a journalistic objectivity, the idea that Walter Cronkite is going to tell you that's the way the world was, or that type of ridiculous, outdated concept that somehow there is some reporter that can float mystically above us all in the clouds and have no biases, which influences the way in which they report the news or even what news they report. As I hope made the argument for in that episode, there is no such thing as journalistic objectivity, and that every journalistic editorial decision is a decision that is steeped in biases and subjectivity, and there's no way around that. Even the question of what subjects to cover and what subjects not to cover is a question that is steeped in subjective biases and preferences and decisions. So, having said that, then I think that part of the problem with DJ Mongo's question is that he incorrectly summarizes that as saying that I am putting forward the idea there is no such thing as objective external reality, that there is no such thing as truth, which is certainly not my intention. That is absolutely not what I believe. I do believe there is an objective external world, which is understandable to a certain extent. I don't think that 100% certainty is ever possible because of the flaws in our perceptions and sensations and our ways of experiencing the world, but I think we can arrive at some sort of understanding of the objective truth of the world, and we can do that in a better or worse way, depending on what methods we use to get there. So that is, I think, not what I was arguing. But on the finer point of whether there's a contradiction between me arguing in episode 265 that journalistic objectivity is a myth, and then me seeming to disparage Ivy Lee's remarks in the GRTV backgrounder, where I quoted him as saying that what is a fact, basically any fact, is my attempt to put forward my views in towards you. I suppose on the limited reading of that Ivy Lee quote, I suppose I do agree with him. Any attempt to portray the objective truth of what's happening in the world in a journalistic format is going to be trying to put forward a viewpoint or another. And on that limited reading, I suppose I am in accord with Ivy Lee's philosophical point there. But of course, I'm absolutely opposed to the agenda that he and his cohorts represented. And I think Ivy Lee, for people who don't know, he was basically the person who invented the PR industry for the Rockefellers on the back of the Ludlow Massacre. And I think that him and his philosophical progeny have been involved in an attempt to convince the public of this idea of journalistic objectivity at the same time as they're trying to subtly manipulate them by putting all of their biases in the background. That is something that I fundamentally object to. If Ivy Lee and his cohorts were completely open about it, hey, look, we work for the Rockefellers and we're trying to put forward the Rockefeller view of the world, I wouldn't even have a particular problem with that type of reporting, because at least it would be all out on the table and people could take it for what it's worth, which is absolutely nothing. It's when they try to hide that I get very suspicious, and why I think it's important for reporters to be upfront with what it is that they believe and what they are advocating. And that's why I make no bones about the fact that that I am absolutely for human liberty, and I'm against the military-industrial complex and these imaginary governments that claim to have authority over human minds, etc., etc. All of my bones are out there on the table for people to take a look at and to do with as they please. So what is the way above this? How can we ever do anything if everything is just going to be contained in these subjective journalistic reports that are necessarily biased, etc., etc.? Well, that was what I was gesturing towards in my presentation in France, talking about open source journalism, which I think represents at least one way of us transcending the biases of any one given source. Obviously, if the journalism that you're looking at is open source, then you can go and explore the source documentation for yourself, and you can look at the source documents. Like, if I talk about Anthony Sutton, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, you can go read that for yourself and come to your own conclusions about the documents that he was looking at and the connections that he drew, etc. So, again, you can source it from all of the various different sources that go into the creation of a report, and I think that's exceptionally important, and that's one way that we can transcend the biases of any one particular source. So a lot to say there. It's an important question. I'm glad you asked it, but I think that there was some confusion there about my opinions, and I certainly do believe there is an objective, true, objectively existing world out there, and I think we can come to some understanding of that. It's just putting that in a journalistic form is necessarily going to bring with it all sorts of problems. Okay, moving along. Next question. We have an email in from Stan, who writes, "In Western civilization, what are the cancer rates like now compared to about 100 years ago? Is there a graph showing a rise?" Okay, good question. Thank you for that, Stan. Well, on that note, we can turn to a lot of different sources. One that offers us some different sources is the National Cancer Institute, which has a statistics page where they link to a lot of different sources for different data from different statistical sources of putting all of this information together. The SEER Cancer Statistics Review, the United States Cancer Statistics, the cancer incidence and mortality patterns, blah, 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 sorted in all sorts of different ways, available from different websites, etc. There's also the National Cancer Institute's Cancer Trends Progress Report, which shows the graph of the incidence of cancer in various populations, sorted by, for example, male and female, and then both sexes combined. This data runs, the data that I'm looking at any rate, the graph runs from 1975 to 2008 and shows, although there has been some upticks and downticks in the incidence of cancer, there is a general trend line upwards. It is sloping upwards from the 1970s to today. So there is an increase in cancer rates, both among males and females, and with an interesting spike in the early 1990s, especially for males. Very interesting indeed. And for some more up-to-date information, we can turn to a WebMD article that I cited briefly, I believe, in the New World Next Week episode not too long ago, just from May of 2012, global cancer rates set to soar by 2030, and there have been more reports in recent months talking about a sharp uptake in breast cancer among women, which is really driving increased cancer incidence overall. So a lot of different data points to look at, and again, don't trust any one source on this. I think you should look into a lot of different sources and see where they agree and disagree, etc. But I think the overall trend that all of them seem to agree on, certainly in the United States context, and I think in the Western world context more generally, is that there is a general uptrend and a sloping uptrend in the incidence of cancer. And interestingly, I think one of the articles that helps put this into perspective is an article from Dr. Mercola at Mercola.com from January of last year. U.S. cancer death rates on the decline, but cancer incidence is still rising, and here's why. So he goes to talk about how fewer people are dying of cancer, but more people are getting cancer. So I think that goes right to the heart of what we were talking about in our Rockefeller Medicine edition of this podcast, talking about the Rockefellerization of medicine and the creation of allopathic medicine as a way of extracting more of the wealth from the dumb masses who will go and pay for this cancer, once you have cancer, trying to treat the cancer rather than looking at the root causes of it, etc., which, again, is just part of keeping you in a system, keeping you sick, keeping you dependent, and keeping you paying more and more of the money to Big Pharma and the Rockefellers and all of those usual suspects. So that's an interesting part of the overall trend, more people getting cancer, fewer people dying of it, just meaning they're living with it and paying more for the radiation treatments and other treatments that are, again, part of contributing to their long and untimely demises. An interesting part of that article, though, specifically is top 12 tips to prevent cancer at the end, which I think is just general good health ideas in general, talking about getting regular good sleep and vitamin D levels, omega-3 to omega-6 fats, etc. All of that, again, in that article, so I'll suggest that you go and take a look at that. So, again, thank you for the question, Stan, and let's move on to the next question along similar health-related lines, this time from Twitter and at Chipper10, who writes, does fluoride affect teeth, one, because of the contact with teeth when drinking brushing, or two, internally from the bloodstream, or both? Okay, excellent. Very good question. I'm glad you asked this. Let's go to the Fluoride Action Network, fluoridealert.org, that has a page specifically devoted to this topic. It's called Topical versus Systemic Effects of Fluoridation. And it goes on to talk about how in the 1940s, back when they were starting to push this water fluoridation idea, which again was pushed by, for example, the aluminum industry, the fertilizer industry, even the nuclear weapon production process, the secondary products of all of this include fluoride and fluorines of various sorts. So they were arguing for fluoridation of the water. And one of the ways they did this was a hypothesis that ingestion of fluoride directly during the creation, the development of teeth in children would be beneficial because the fluoride would then become part of the tooth. It would be incorporated into the tooth in the eruption and would help to protect the enamel in future years, so that it would last a lifetime of benefit from the ingestion of fluoride when a child is developing their teeth. That was the hypothesis in the 40s. It was promoted again in the 1950s by public health service chiefs, etc. But as this fluoridealert.org article shows, in July of 2000, even the Journal of the American Dental Association itself admitted that this was a flawed hypothesis, that, quote, fluoride incorporated during tooth development is insufficient to play a significant role in caries protection. That was also backed up by the Center for Disease Control, which stated in 1999, quote, fluoride prevents dental caries predominantly after eruption of the tooth into the mouth, and its actions primarily are topical for both adults and children. So translation into regular everyday speech, drinking fluoride is about as effective for preventing dental cavities as drinking sunscreen would be to preventing sunburns. It is not an effective way of doing that. It's not healthy, as we know from all of the studies that show all of the adverse effects to fluoride. And even the phony idea that they cooked up, the hypothesis they cooked up in the 40s as to why they should fluoridate the water, they don't even go along with that anymore. Neither the American Dental Association nor the Center for Disease Control says that, that drinking fluoride, ingesting fluoride is beneficial to preventing cavities. So, there you go. That's the official answer. Again, even from the official sources, of course, both the ADA and the CDC still recommend fluoridation. In fact, the CDC, I believe, called fluoridation one of the most beneficial public health programs of all time. But that's just because, well, again, it's just complete, utter propaganda. But the truth there is at fluoridealert.org, so I'll point people to that page. Let's move along to Phil, who writes, thank you for introducing me to John Taylor Gatto via your links. During a 2-day marathon, which ended today, I managed to read The Underground History of American Education. I can now see how workplace is meant to simulate the school environment for a scientifically managed, dumbed-down, docile workforce. At both school and work, fear and distrust is invoked by an authoritarian setup of minimum accountability while micromanaging others with carrots, sticks, scorecards, salary ratings, etc. Self-esteem is further eroded by constant changes and chaos in the workplace, ongoing distractions, info overload, and purposeless busyness resulting in a wastage of time, talent, and resources. Then, while individual resourcefulness is actively discouraged, employee satisfaction surveys are sent out. Is this some kind of experiment measuring employee dissatisfaction, or is this just another way to play with our heads? Thank you for that, Phil, and I think the answer is yes to both questions. I think it's a little bit of a combination. Maybe in the same way that voting is not just a way of getting people to participate in the process and make them feel that they've had a say in what happens, which is actually an exceptionally important part of what voting is all about. But also, I think it is a way of for the powers that shouldn't be to gauge where the electorate is and what they might be experiencing. So they get to see the real results before the doctored results come out the other side of the black box voting machine, telling us which candidate has been selected, pre-selected to become the president or governor or mayor or what have you. So I think that it does have that function. It is these employee satisfaction surveys are a way to get one employee buy-in to the system, so the employees feel like they've had some say over it. And I have the feeling I have seen a study that said something to that effect, that employees who were asked their opinion about whether they should have fluorescent lights or tungsten lights or whatever it was, were more likely to feel happier about whatever happened afterwards, regardless of whether their suggestions were taken into account or not, than employees who were not asked. So basically just asking someone their opinion gets them to buy into it, gets them to pretend that they've had some sort of say over it, gets them to feel happier and improves productivity, supposedly. So that's one part of it. And again, I think it is playing with people's heads. So yes, a very interesting little part of that, employee satisfaction surveys. It makes you wonder why there aren't more attempts to solicit satisfaction surveys or some sort of buy-in for students in the school system. Maybe they just don't want to even get students thinking along the lines of even beginning to question the authority that's been placed over them. Because by the time they're workers in the system, they've already had their backs broken by the 18 years of indoctrination they've had up to that point. So I guess it's all part of that system. All right, let's move on to the next question from Mookie, who writes, what's the best and freest way of uploading data so that others can download easily? Yeah, very important question. And I guess I don't know what to advocate because, again, anything that you upload, I mean, first of all, we should understand that that privacy is something of a pipe dream when you're uploading data, whatever type of encryption you use. So again, let's not get into that whole section of it. But just if you want to share some sort of information widely and broadly and quickly and easily and freely, how do you do it? Well, obviously, BitTorrents are still very popular. I don't actually torrent myself, but I know a lot of people out there do. And in fact, I've had people email me to say that they want to torrent the Corbett Report podcast and seed it. And by all means, please, 100%. This information is provided completely out there, freely available to the public. I use the Creative Commons 2.5 non-attribution, non-commercial license. So you are free to go and take it and use it, repurpose it, republish it, mirror it, put it out in BitTorrents, get it up out to the four winds however you want, and I hope that you do so that it gets out there to as many people as humanly possible. And BitTorrents might be one way of doing that, again, if you just want something free and fast and relatively easy way of sharing information wider. All right, let's move on. Doug writes, I have written a book of social commentary poetry and would like to have a role in the social commentary like yourself. How would you recommend to get my message out? Book, blog, site? Do you know of any self-publishing site that can help? Very important question. I'm sure a lot of people have questions along these lines, people who are interested in getting their own ideas out there and who are willing to take up my call for more people to get actively involved in this. So I think publishing a book, sure. Truth poetry, awesome. Add your voice to the mix. That's great. I don't have a specific recommendation for sites. There are a lot of sites out there by which you can self-publish these days. You can go by through the belly of the beast through Amazon and places like that, CreateSpace or whatever they have. There are other, I'm sure, smaller, more independent places, but I think self-publishing is the way to go in this day and age. I can't imagine why or how anyone would want to work within the publishing industry and go through that traditional process in this age where you can reach out and directly interact with an audience without any need for a mediator. But of course, having said that, you're not going to have an audience at all if no one knows you, so you would have to make efforts and inroads somehow. I think having a blog associated with your poetry book, website, however you want to set that up, I think that couldn't hurt. Having a podcast, why not? Building up an audience who's interested in what you're interested in and then will support your work, I think that's a good way to go about it. And when and if I ever get my book finished, I hope that people who are interested in the Corbett Report will support it. And I think that there's already an audience for that type of book because I built up the website. Of course, that wasn't why I built up the website, but it's nice to have that and to have the ability to get my message out and heard. But again, it's an awful lot of work to keep and to grow and keep and maintain an audience. So obviously, it's something that's transformative and will probably transform your life along the way. Again, however you choose to do that, I think it's going to take a lot of effort, but I hats off to you and anyone else who gets in that ring, and I salute everyone who's trying to get the word out through whatever method, whatever gift, whatever talent you have. Use it for the propagation of truth and happiness and something nice in this world, creating something beautiful rather than trying to tear it apart. All right, let's move on to Rob, who writes, I would be curious what your thoughts are on this study. Do you think it's legit? And he links to a study that has recently come out. It's by Robert J. Brule. It's published in Springer Science Business Media, and it's called Institutionalizing Delay, Foundation Funding, and the Creation of U.S. Climate Change Counter-Movement Organizations. Basically, this is some big news study talking about the funding of these climate change deniers and where it all comes from, or that's how this study is being portrayed in the media, simplification anyway, and oh wow, it's now been conclusively found it's not just the Koch brothers and Exxon, it's all these people who are funding the climate change denial movement, because there's no one who doesn't believe the AGW hype and catastrophe who hasn't been secretly getting oil money of one sort or another, according to thoroughly ridiculous websites that I will stop naming it because I've named it a number of times. Well, one that wrote one about me specifically, actually, talking about how my $5 a month ClimateGate.tv website was being secretly funded by the oil industry, apparently. Very, very funny. But yes, here's another, and this is a peer-reviewed scientific paper on this, so it must be serious. Lots of different ways to counter what's being said there, but I hope people will go beyond the headlines, go beyond the interviews that you might be seeing even in certain alternative media outlets about this study. Look at the actual paper itself and examine what it actually says. A great article that does that and breaks down what it's saying is up on whatsupwiththat.com, which had a report being bullish on Robert Brule's dark money smear of skeptics. And it's an excellent article, and it goes into a lot of reasons that he comes to the ultimate conclusion that ultimately, Brule's definition of denier is anyone that he dislikes. And he goes into that specifically talking about this climate change counter movement that he's trying to define, and he defines it as this movement is an efficacious approach to defining this movement is to view it as a cultural contestation between a social movement advocating restrictions on carbon emissions and a counter movement opposed to such action. So basically, anyone who's opposed to any restrictions on carbon is one of these deniers and is obviously getting funding from, you know, these nefarious sources. But funnily enough, people who are opposed to things like cap and trade, regulations on carbon, who are also supportive of the catastrophic AGW agenda, like James Hansen, one of the people who helped kick off this whole hysteria in the 1980s with his preposterously and completely wrong projections of temperature increase that he had projected, he gets off the hook, even though he's against cap and trade because he thinks it's going to be completely ineffective. And it's going to be a boondoggle where Wall Street's going to fleece the public out of billions of dollars. And, hey, I actually agree with him on those points. But he's not a denier in Brule's categorization because he's on his side. But other organizations, even ones that do support different types of mitigation, like the Global Climate Coalition, somehow does find it grouped in with that counter-climate change movement that he's trying to define. So again, it's a completely made-up, arbitrary definition. He's just trying to have his cake and eat it too. And so we have to deconstruct that. And probably the best way to do that is to point once again to something like Joe Nova at joannova.com.au, who had a post back a few years ago now, back in 2009, talking about the climate industry, $79 billion so far, trillions to come, talking about even at that point, 5 years ago now, so it's half a decade out of date, and thus tens or hundreds of billions of dollars out of date, but talking about how $79 billion, at the very least, could be found to directly source from the U.S. government to pay for various climate change science and technology research, foreign aid, tax breaks, etc., since 1989 to 2009. So in that 20-year period, $79 billion. And then the trillions of dollars, literally trillions, that have been proposed in carbon markets around the world yet to come. So is there money to be made in the climate hysteria? Oh, yes. But for some reason, people never talk about that side of the equation. It's only, where are these climate deniers getting their money from? Well, again, I have yet to receive my check from Exxon, so I'll wait for that in the mailbox. And, you know, maybe I'll go check after I'm done recording this, see if it's arrived yet. Again, just more preposterousness from the usual people, and again, more of the type of ludicrousness that will make for great headlines. Ooh, new academic paper finds climate denier funds or whatever, and once you start to actually look into it, it turns out to be completely fraudulent. On the climate change note, Mandy also writes, is there a longer report on climate myths debunked? It seems you've just highlighted how bad statistics and cherry-picking the facts can turn black into white. It's not your usual standard, so I fear I've missed something. No offense meant. All right, thank you, Mandy. No offense taken, I guess, if you say so. But I think that is, well, if not offensive, it's just, again, it just goes to show that there's no way you can win when producing media of any sort, because either you produce the short type of punchy reports that have the kind of broad appeal that will get people to watch, and you get lots of people to watch, and then they critique it because it's not a long report. So you make long reports that are very detailed and have lots of links, but that's too long and boring. No one will watch it. So you do a mixture of both, the short and the long reports, and someone who only sees the short report will critique you for not doing the long reports, which you actually are doing. So again, you cannot win with production of media, but oh well, what's the difference. You just got to continue to try. So anyway, yes, talking about my 10 climate myths debunked in 60 seconds, which again lives up to its name. It was 60 seconds debunking 10 climate myths. Obviously, that's not ample time to give any sort of justice to any sort of debunking, which is why there was a transcript of that debunking that was linked up in the show notes for that. Again, always in the YouTube video. If you're watching the YouTube video, the show notes are linked right underneath the video. Just click on that. It'll take you to my site. You can go and read the transcript and click on all the links. And if you did so, you would have found all of the links to more detailed explanations of the various points I was making in that video. But even above and beyond that, not only have I done a longer report on debunking climate myths, I have done dozens of them, podcasts, radio shows, interviews, you name it. I've done dozens and dozens of hours on this. So I think time is, it's high time that once again we go to the desktop and take a look at how to use the search function on my website. All right, so for those of you who are watching the video of this podcast, you can see that we're on the homepage of CorbettReport.com, and up in the right-hand corner, we have a handy little search box. So if you want to search for anything, for example, climate, to find out what else I've done on climate in the past, just type it into the search box right there, click enter, and away you go. You can find out all of my various articles and podcasts and interviews that I've done over the years, and see many, many, many many, many, many more reports than that one little report that that person was writing about. So let's keep this in mind. This handy-dandy search box is your friend. You can use it to search for all sorts of different subjects or previous interview guests or that type of thing if you are curious as to what I've covered in the past. Okay, and just sticking on this climate change theme for another couple of questions, we have one in from Kimberly who writes, are you no longer running a ClimateGate website? Tried finding it to link to, but it seems to be gone. Thank you, Kimberly. I've mentioned this a few times now. Let's put it on the record once again. I used to have a website, climategate.tv, which was specifically about the catastrophic anthropogenic global warming hysteria and specifically the debunking thereof that was being updated on a regular basis. But that website went by the wayside. I didn't have the time or energy or ability to keep that up on a daily basis. So I let that domain name expire. All of the original reports that I wrote or the video reports that I did for ClimateGate.tv have been preserved on my YouTube channel on CorbettReport.com. Nothing is missing. All the rest were just articles that I had linked to from various different websites. So no information was lost. It's just that that website doesn't exist anymore. I would love to be able to maintain something like that, but it's enough work to even just do FukushimaUpdate.com, which again, I hope people are checking on a regular basis. It's being updated on a daily basis at this point, with several news stories a day. So I hope people are keeping track of that. But again, I really, really wish that I was able to do a news aggregator website generally. And in fact, that was from the very, very beginning of the Corbett Report, something that I had originally intended to do the Corbett Report podcast and then to have a different website for a news aggregator. And I just have never been able to because the podcast and this work takes all of my time. So who knows, maybe at some point in the future, when and if I can afford assistance, blah, blah, blah. You know the deal. All right, let's move on to Subi, who writes, I find your analysis of the IPCC interesting. Currently, I am in a fourth-year post-sec science course where we are discussing climate change in depth. My instructor graduated from East Anglia, and therefore it would appear that I would be getting pretty good information. If you had the opportunity to ask questions in a direct manner, what issues would you bring up, especially in a class where students discuss the Inconvenient Truth movie as well as the IPCC? Thank you for your time. Thank you for your question, Subi. Very interesting indeed. Oh, a graduate of East Anglia, the ClimateGate Central. Very interesting. And, on that note specifically, I would really suggest that you go and look up the articles that Tim Ball has written about the University of East Anglia and the Climate Research Center that they have and how it first developed under a climate scientist that Tim Ball has much respect for and then was taken over by Tom Wiegand and his progeny, his philosophical progeny, and how that really changed the note and tenor of what they were doing and what that institution was all about. So there's a lot to go into, and I'd be fascinated to hear what someone from the inside of East Anglia had to say about the ClimateGate leak and, you know, what was behind that and blah, blah, blah. I'm sure it would be a lot of propaganda, but still be interesting to hear. But anyway, with regards to the IPCC specifically, I will again direct people to, I have a copy here, the 2009 Video Archive DVD where I have that interview with Dr. Tim Ball talking specifically about the IPCC. It's also available for free on YouTube in our recent podcast episode on the IPCC, the IPCC Exposed, I believe. In which we talked about this and we played that interview with Dr. Tim Ball talking about the IPCC and specifically how, A, the frame of reference determines what any sort of institution is going to find. So if the frame of reference is they're looking for the human causes of global warming, then guess what? They're going to find human causes of global warming, not solar variability and the like. And secondly, also the summary for policymakers. Why is it that the summary for policymakers, which is pretending to summarize the scientific report, is released before the scientific report that it claims to be summarizing? And why is it the scientific report has to be altered to be in line with the summary for policymakers, which is decided on in committee meetings by diplomats? Why is that if this is such an august scientific institution? That would be something that I'd like to get to the bottom of from someone who is an IPCC believer. Just a couple of the issues raised there in that previous episode, so I'll direct people to that. And once again, the link will be in the show notes. Okay, we are running out of time, so let's just get to the last couple of questions, squeeze a couple more in. One from YouTube user IZANDB, IZANDB, who writes, question for Corbett, since you live in Japan, do you ever watch anime? And the answer is no, I do not. Next is Ryan, who writes in with, as I say, we always want to highlight someone who has a positive story of the way that they've implemented some changes in their lives for the better. This is Ryan's story that he'd like to share. So he says, instead of a question, I would like to share with you and your audience some of the positive experiences I've had developing out of the system and how the Corbett Report has aided me in this journey. As a former corporate techie, I began watching your program per a friend's recommendation. After contemplating the grand scale of corruption uncovered through your podcasts, I decided enough was enough. I ditched my job in Florida, dropped out of the university, sold all my belongings, and moved to a remote island off the coast of Washington. Due to the nature of the community, I quickly learned how to live off the grid, engaging in activities like hunting, foraging, and growing my own food medicine. In less than a year, my entire life has been transformed. During my quest for deeper knowledge and positive global change, I became attached to natural medicine and healing. In a country ravaged by disease, obesity, and medical misinformation, my partner and I began reaching out to friends, family, and the community who were most affected. In the past few months, we have successfully cured, as verified by a medical professional, friends of diseases like cancer, COPD, and others using fresh herbs grown in our garden. For less than a dollar, these individuals have been able to drop thousands of dollars worth of pharmaceuticals and up their quality of life. I didn't learn any of these practical life skills from the educational system, and as highlighted in your podcast, there has been no greater time in history to educate ourselves than now with the advent of the internet. So please, listeners of the Corbett, get out there, pursue your passions, and use this tool for good. I know I'll be starting my own blog and creating videos exploring these topics come spring. Thank you, James, for inspiring me to conduct my own research against all odds, and without your advice, I would surely be stuck under the scalpel of Rockefeller medicine. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for that that interesting testimonial, and I'm sure we will all be looking forward to your blog when it gets started in the spring, so forward it on, and I'll let people know about it. So good to know that you're at least on the grid enough to be able to send that message to us, and that you are still interacting and trying to bring this message to other people. Again, I couldn't echo those sentiments more heartily than Ryan put them. I think people should be using this technology to educate yourself and to get off the system in whatever way you can, in whatever way you're able to be as self-sufficient as possible, because again, if we're dependent on the system, then we are going to be victims of that system, because it is not meant to benefit you or I. And finally, on the last note, John Brady writes in, James, I have a question. I've become a subscriber of the Boiling Frog site. However, I am hoping to support you. Is this the best way to do it? Well, John, thank you very much for supporting Boiling Frogs. I contribute to Boiling Frogs. I volunteer to work for them. I do all of my work completely for free for them. That's why the Boiling Frogs post eye-opener is now available freely online on YouTube, because I'm donating it for free, so I don't get a single penny from Boiling Frogs. So I do appreciate that people subscribe to them. I hope that people do subscribe to help support Sibel and the work of all the people at Boiling Frogs, but I don't see a single penny of that. If people want to support me and my work specifically, you do so from CorbettReport.com. You can donate, you can subscribe to the newsletter, you can get DVDs. That's how I basically earn my living, how I put roof over my head and food on my table and help to feed my child. So I really do rely on your guys' support out there. I really do hope you will continue to support me as we move forward into 2014. Lots of questions yet to be answered and not enough time to do so, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. Once again, I do appreciate all of the information, feedback, questions, comments, complaints, criticisms, and helpful suggestions that I get in through the contact form and through all the various ways that you can reach me. I'm looking forward to doing this again, and in the meantime, thank you all for listening. Take care.